I'm Ed Howard with the Alliance for Health Reform. Thank you for joining us. I want to welcome you on behalf of Senator Collins, Senator Rockefeller, and our board of directors to this program to examine the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act and its provisions as it affects private health insurance coverage. Last week we focused on Medicaid and reform. Next Friday we'll be looking at Medicare and reform. So look for that one in your email boxes this afternoon. Uniquely in America, I think we have a mix of public and private sources of coverage, and for better or for worse, both elements are going to continue as the new law is implemented. But there are, as none of you will be surprised to learn, sweeping changes in store for the private insurance industry, and they're going to affect what gets sold, to whom, at what cost, and in what forum the sale gets made, among other things. And some of these changes have already gone into effect. Some of them won't go into effect until 2014 or even longer. What we do know is that very few of us are going to be unaffected by these changes. Those of you who work for a member of Congress are probably going to have to get your coverage from one of these new state-operated exchanges once they're in place rather than the Federal Employees Program. So it's something you have a personal stake in as well as a policy stake. Today's program's designed to help us all learn a little more about exactly how the reform law is changing almost every aspect of private health insurance. And we're going to try to give everybody a relatively objective look at what's in there, as we've been calling this series. And we're very pleased, once again, to have as a partner in these programs the Kaiser Family Foundation, which, if you haven't gone to their website and looked at their analytical tools about the reform law, you're really missing out, because both the material that's posted there and the interactive calculators that are embedded in that site are among the most helpful tools you're going to find to help you understand exactly what's going on in the reform world. And with that, I'd like to present my co-moderator, Diane Rowland, who serves both as the Executive Vice President of the Foundation and the Executive Director of the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured. Diane? Yeah.
Well, thank you, Ed, and thank you all for coming on this beautiful day to hear about the private health insurance changes in the health reform legislation in this inside room that has a nice view for those of us at the panel, and you're all facing us, which is where all of the discussion will take place. We're really pleased at Kaiser to be able to sponsor this set of looks at the inside of some of the changes in the health reform legislation. I think this three-part series is just the first of many that we will be doing to look at the legislation as the regs are written and as implementation gears up. But I think that this particular session really offers a chance to think about the private insurance side and the many changes there. And so I'm glad you're joining us today for that, and I look forward to having many of you back when we talk about Medicare next week. And without further ado, I think there's enough to talk about in the private health insurance changes that I want to thank the panelists who are here with us today and give them the opportunity to start the process of explaining and questioning some of these provisions. Thank you.
Thanks, Diane. Very quickly, there'll be a webcast available of this session on Monday at the KFF.org website, a transcript on the Alliance website a few days later. That's allhealth.org. At the appropriate time, you have green question cards you can use, and that's going to be the heart of this session, trying to respond to your questions. And there's a blue evaluation form that I would urge you to fill out when the appropriate time occurs. Let me just, in keeping with Diane's expression of the intent to get the panelists the maximum time to talk, let me just go through very brief introductions for each of them up front, and then we won't interrupt the discussion with my rambling introductions. We're going to hear first from Gary Claxton. He's a vice president and director of the Healthcare Marketplace Project at the Kaiser Family Foundation. And many of you know him. He's been a senior official at HHS and at Georgetown and stints at AARP and NAIC. He's knows as much about private health insurance as anybody in this town. Then we'll hear from Chris Kohler, who's, I think, starting his sixth year as the very first health insurance commissioner in Rhode Island, and he's been very active in the National Association of Insurance Commissioners as well. And then finally, we'll hear from Scott Kiefer, who's the vice president of policy development at America's Health Insurance Programs, AHIP, where his duties include promoting improved access to private insurance. So more information about them in your materials. If you haven't looked at the website at allhealth.org, the briefing page there for this briefing has a lot of background information that will be helpful to you in addition to what's in your packet. So let's start off with Gary and get an overview of what this new law is all about. Gary?
Is this working? Oh, good. Thanks. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to try and give you a brief overview roadmap of what's going on and then get to questions. And luckily, they haven't started my time yet, which is great. When you look at the insurance changes here, they really vary in terms of timing and to whom and to which companies and parts of the market they apply. We kind of broke them up into two pieces. There's the early changes that occur mostly starting within about 6 months from when the law passed, but then some of them trickle in later through different processes. Those changes are implemented in the context of the current marketplace. So they really do operate within the way the markets work now in different states. Because state markets, particularly individual insurance markets, but also small group rules differ, the way these changes affect the participants in those markets are going to vary a little bit by state. There's a lot less uniformity than will occur with the bigger changes that occur, which will be the large ones that occur in 2014. This is when the subsidies start to become available, when the individual requirement kicks into place, and when you really have a pretty fundamental redesign of the individual insurance market and some pretty big changes probably in the small group market as well. Excuse me, I have a visitor on my... There's really three markets that exist now. There's sub-markets, but there's really three markets, three levels of the market that exist now, and those will continue after this, all the reforms are put in place. There's non-group market. Those are people who buy insurance on their own. There's the small group market, which is probably currently small groups with 2 to 50 employees. The legislation really extends that to 100 employees with some state flexibility there. And then there's the large group market, which is obviously employers with more employees than that. There's also variation in how the provisions apply to plans about in terms of whether they're insured or self-funded. And then finally, there's going to be variation that applies to what's called grandfathered plans or new plans. Grandfathered plans are health plans that existed on the day the act was passed, and to the extent they don't make too many changes, they'll be able to keep that status, and many of the provisions don't apply to grandfathered plans. I think the key point to remember here, though, is that these different markets will remain in effect even after reform. Sometimes people talk about there being one large risk pool after reform. That's really not the case. If you look at the early insurance exchanges, I broke them up into three categories. Again, most of these take effect in September later this year, a few of them earlier. I broke them up into access, benefits, and value. I think the major access provision that takes effect right away is the temporary high-risk pool, which is $5 billion worth of funds that the Secretary can use to working with the states to provide immediate access to people who would otherwise be turned down for private insurance. Still don't know exactly how that's going to look. There's some issues with how it's going to interact with existing state risk pools. You've heard, and the IRS recently issued some guidance on provisions that extend group insurance coverage to individuals, I guess group and individual insurance coverage, to dependents of policyholders until age 26. There's provisions which eliminate pre-existing condition exclusions for children or for individuals under 19. There's also provisions that restrict rescissions. Then there's some benefit provisions which start to take effect right away or, again, within a few months. There's a complete elimination of lifetime limits, dollar limits on benefits. There's restrictions on annual benefit limits. Those apply differently in the individual and group market. There's access to preventive services without cost sharing for new plans. There's some provisions that extend the right to have to choose different professionals to be your primary care doctor or give you access to services. And there's also the requirement for plans, group health plans, and individual plans to implement an appeals process. Then there's some provisions that I would call value provisions. There's new minimum loss ratios that are put into effect starting basically next year. 80% for individual insurance and 85% for group insurance. There's the secretary and the states are supposed to develop a process for looking at unreasonable rate increases. There's reporting on a number of factors. The NAIC and the secretary will work together to create some standardized or uniform explanation of coverage, which will take effect. And then there's going to be a federal website to try to direct people to affordable coverage options. Then there's the sort of bigger changes that take effect in 2014. These are the ones that really restructure the marketplace, and the reason they can do that is because federal subsidies become available for low-income people to get access to health insurance. So there'll be many new entrants into the market. There's also a requirement that many people have health insurance. Again, those requirements that people participate in insurance allow access to insurance to be provided without as much concern about adverse selection. So again, breaking these up into access, benefits, and value, provisions apply that require insurers to accept people without regard to health status and not discriminate against people with regard to health status. Rate variation based on health status basically goes away. Most other rate factors are either eliminated or limited. Age rating is limited to 3-1. There will now be a complete elimination of pre-existing condition exclusions and a limit on waiting periods in group health plans. In the benefit area, there's an establishment of an essential benefits package, which has a comprehensive list of services, structures cost sharing into four different levels, and puts limits on out-of-pocket liability, and there's also some additional limits on deductibles for group health plans. The other sort of big thing that happens then is health insurance exchanges come into place. States set up health insurance exchanges, which are marketplaces where individuals in the non-group market and in the beginning in the small group market can shop for health insurance that meets these standards. It is, like I said, available without regard to health status. The idea of exchanges is to allow better comparability among for consumers to purchase health plans and to encourage competition based on somewhat different level, fairly standardized levels of coverage so people can make comparisons and hopefully prices will be reduced through competition. I've got a minute left. I have to correct something on the slide. So health insurance exchanges are going to be developed by states. The secretary has some money to help that she can provide to help states create them. There's going to be a separate health insurance exchange for small employers. States would have the option of merging their exchanges for individuals and for small employers. And what's wrong on my slide is I say that employees can only have access to the exchange in certain circumstances, but that's not true. Basically, any individual who is lawfully here and not in jail can go into a health insurance exchange. If you are offered employer-sponsored insurance and what you would have to pay exceeds 9.5% of your income, you're eligible for subsidies in the exchange. If it exceeds 8% of your income, but not 9.5% of your income, you are able to go to the exchange and take your employer contribution with you. It's called a free choice waiver. And I'm done. So I listed some questions and challenges, which we can talk about through questions.
Great. Thank you. Chris?
Thank you very much, Ed and Diane, and thank you all of you for coming.
I'm not sure the microphone is. How's that?
Yeah, this is on.
Oh, he got 15 minutes.
I especially want to thank the Kaiser Family Foundation for putting this together, as well as the Alliance for Health Reform. I think these exchanges are very important, given the enormity of the tasks that we're taking on. What I'm going to talk about in my presentation is what we as states are doing now, what we need to be thinking about for the future, and then just kind of a voice from out in the countryside as to what some of our challenges and needs are. I don't speak for all states, you know, Rhode Island, population of 1 million, 30 by 40, but hopefully I can represent some of the different perspectives that are out there. And before I get into it, I just want to emphasize, this is a really important opportunity. This is a significant task for, I was talking to Diane before this started, this is what a lot of people have been waiting for, working for, and now we got the chance and we want to make sure that we follow the statute and that we do it right. So it's kind of a privilege to be doing this, actually, with that out of the way. Fortunately, my stuff overlaps pretty well with Gary, so I'm just going to talk about the challenges. First of all, with the high-risk pool grants, today's the deadline. States that are in are supposed to indicate to Health and Human Services that they are in by the end of today. There's an article in the New York Times indicating how that process has been used by people with various different agendas for various different reasons. From Rhode Island's standpoint, we will be sending in a letter indicating our intent to proceed. We have a number of concerns relating to the flexibility that's going to be afforded to us, given that we don't have a high-risk pool, and the certainty of the funds going forward. If HHS is able to meet those concerns, I'm reasonably optimistic that we'll be able to work something out in our state. I will say that HHS, and you'll hear this a number of times, has been flexible with taking the statute, following the letter of the law, but also understanding what it's working towards. In our case, we don't have a high-risk pool, but we have sick people who don't have access to health insurance. So how can we use these new funds, adhere to the statute, but work to make it happen? And I can talk about how we hope to do it in Rhode Island. On the short-term commercial health insurance reforms, I would characterize our main need there as communications. I was at a business group meeting earlier just a couple days ago. They had tons of questions that we couldn't answer because we didn't want to throw the feds under the bus, but basically the feds haven't come up with the answer. So in the meantime, how do we communicate this information? A good example is kids under 26 when they're on. When do they come on? The plans are moving early. What does that mean? My kid's off now. How do they get back on? Is it as of a certain date or is it when the plan renews? I'm on a self-insured plan. Is my kid covered? People are coming to us because we are the local insurance representatives. We don't necessarily know the answers. What's going to be our role in communicating those types of information? I think the other thing we have to think about with these is the operational impact. We have to review every form that comes in from the health insurers for compliance with federal mandate, with state mandates, and now with federal mandates. Are those forms all going to come in at once? Are they going to come in upon renewal? What is the checklist that we're going to use? We have people back in our offices who are very just concerned about workflow issues. So those are it's mostly operational implementation challenges associated with the commercial insurance reforms, the short-term stuff, and a lot of just lack of information. People don't know. The other things are there's a grants in the short term is a grants for state ombudsman program and then the national web portal. We don't have any information on that. I'll talk a little bit about that later on. The long-term stuff, you've already gone through this, so I'm going to go through this slide and actually, because this is just what's there and this is how we're reacting. I'd say the states are going through stages of grief around accepting the fact that their world has changed. And, you know, we're going from denial to acceptance to working with it. The second thing is the aggressive states are establishing interagency planning groups. Those are contingent somewhat on what's where our current governor is. If your governor is term limited, there's going to be less appetite to put together interagency planning groups if someone new is coming in January. We rely heavily on our D.C. associations. Josh Goldberg's here from the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. Particularly NAIC on the commercial side has relied a lot on standards, so it's very much taxing their internal process. As I mentioned, we have to do a lot of stakeholder education and communication. The exchange is very important. The only thing close to exchanges in terms of strategic vagueness is accountable care organizations. No one knows what they mean, and so they're in the eye of the beholder. So the most important thing for states to decide is, what are your goals of an exchange? To quote Alan Weil, is it an exchange or is it an exchange? Once you decide those sorts of things, then you can begin planning. The most important thing is going to be integration between commercial insurance regulation and Medicaid, which has never happened before. And then we in the states have to work on the issues that federal health reform did not address, primarily cost. And you see that played out in Massachusetts. But we still have to work on transforming our delivery system. There are more tools that reform puts in place, but the hard work is working on primary care, working on payment reform, and those have been left to the states and to the local communities. Where I want to close is sort of looking down the pike and where things, I think, will come back to you in Washington, but also us. These two charts just dictate how insurance is underwritten right now, the local state rules. And federal reform is pretty clear that eventually we're going to end up looking like the blue. This is not a red state, blue state thing, but if you look up there, we're going towards adjusted community rating for both individuals and small groups. And the process of getting there is going to be very, very painful. There will be winners and losers because we're moving from here, this kind of premium variation, to here. You will not hear from the people who have their premiums reduced. You will hear from the people who have their premiums raised. There will be enormous pressure on it. This is just the same thing with the individual market. It's even worse in the individual market because the white says there are no rules at all, and we are trying to move towards adjusted community rating. That process is going to be taxing on both federal officials and on state officials. It is, as Gary said, it's federalism made real in terms of how standardized do we want to make this thing. The political response in the bill is around the grandfathering of old plans. There is a issue brief from the NAIC in there. What that means is if you are in a plan with existing underwriting rules, you do not have to move from that. That's a recipe for disaster, speaking as an insurance commissioner. I'm less worried about it in our state because we are one of the blue states. But for other states, you have what's the potential for what we call adverse selection. I think there's going to be enormous pressure on both the state officials and on the federal officials to address that going forward. Our second challenge is around partnerships. So far, we have very much appreciated the flexibility of the new folks at HHS, the OCIIO, in terms of how they're working. They get the idea of flexibility. They're coming to the states and asking them what they think. We're hopeful that that can proceed going forward. And it's important to have confidence in those roles because this is really complicated. We're going to continue to work on communicating to stakeholders because this is change, and while there are efforts in Washington, people turn to their local officials first, and then there's an ongoing need for resources. I think I'm going to stop there ahead of time. Thanks.
Thank you, Chris. Turn to Scott Kiefer. Scott?
Thank you, Ed, and thank you, Diane. I sort of want to echo the compliment to Diane and to Gary. For those of you who haven't seen the Kaiser materials, they're terrific in attempting to distill down what is really sort of weighty stuff. I also want to pick up on Gary and Chris and suggest that everyone who thought getting a bill done was the hard part, you're in for a surprise because I think implementation, I think in many ways, is going to be an equal challenge. What I want to do is focused from an industry perspective. Of course, I'm going to be discussing many of the same issues that Gary and Chris touched on, but I want to provide a little more flavor of some of the things that the plans are focused on to keep this interesting and informative in advance of questions. So when we talk about implementation efforts that are underway, and I apologize with the light, it's difficult to see that top bar. But the first thing I'd like to point out is something that folks really haven't discussed much to date, and that is the opportunity to transform and simplify our administrative structures and systems. And prior to the enactment of reform, the industry embarked on a collaboration with physician groups, with the hospital associations, both in Ohio and New Jersey, to essentially do a test run for developing a unified payment system that also would provide claim status and eligibility information to consumers on a pilot basis, so essentially we can run the traps. Without getting too much into the weeds on this, I think it's helpful just to think about sort of what an ATM represents today, and that each person sort of has their own bank-issued card, but it comes through one unified system, and that's what we're piloting in these states. The second two pieces that I want to mention, one that's not up there, rescissions, we addressed this week in an effort to implement that provision early, develop a third-party review standard for rescissions and conform to the law. That happened as the slides were in development. And then dependent coverage, for those who didn't see, we sort of took a quick look at some of the early reforms, and dependent coverage was right up there because it's proved very popular. But also, from a policy standpoint, it makes eminent sense. And when we look at some of the data, we know that kids coming out of college and young people have the highest incidence of uninsurance. So there's actually a positive policy signal in terms of getting everybody in, important for the broader reforms. Children's pre-existing conditions. And then the final point I want to mention is we've been working with many Chris and many of his colleagues at the NIAC on a transparency standard to present and sort of decompose in a consumer-friendly way what goes into a premium increase. And transparency is one thing that we hope will be sort of uniformly adopted and promoted throughout the various provisions in health reform going forward so that we can have more competition and consumers are empowered. I think quickly to touch on a few of these, I think what Gary would characterize as value, I sort of list as regulatory. I think we'll flip a coin and we'll call it value / regulatory. But to say that that a number of those are going to have broad impacts on the industry. Rescissions, I mentioned. Gary covered sort of the gamut of external review and some of the other provisions. I think it's helpful perhaps for folks to think about the MLR and the premium rate review provision in concert because we certainly look at them that way. And without getting too much into detail on the MLR or the premium rate review, it's safe to say that the federal government is going to have an increasing role in something that traditionally has been the providence of the states. And we think federalism and collaboration with Chris and his colleagues is really important, especially given that health markets are indeed local and will largely remain so. With respect to the MLR, issue.
MLR is?
I'm sorry. Forgive me for the jargon. Medical loss ratio. With respect to the MLR, I do want to flag one issue, and that is the challenges in the existing individual market. So as Gary mentioned, this goes into effect largely for plans next year, whereas some of the benefits of the exchanges, for example, and lower administrative costs are going to be largely be in 2014. So in some ways, we're applying a mindset of the 2014 market to the existing market, which is a real challenge. Fortunately, the Secretary has discretion and authority to ensure that local plans, smaller plans, and new plans, that there's some flexibility there from a regulatory standpoint, which is critical. The second bucket Gary touched on as well, Chris also touched on. I think one thing I'd like to make a comment on is the small business tax credits. I think this is a real opportunity perhaps for some firms that previously offered coverage but may have dropped out because of the challenges of the economy or may have had individuals drop out because their costs were rising. Hopefully this will be enough, but I think the impact remains to be seen. We know generally the tax credits have to be pretty generous for broad take-up, and these are not necessarily real generous in the interim. On the benefit side, the only thing I want to say is that one thing we don't know is the broad impact on premiums, the impact on provider capacity, and the challenges that that pose. So, for example, first dollar coverage for preventive benefits, A and B grade on the Preventive Services Task Force, something the industry supports, something that is also going to cause perhaps a surge, as it did in Massachusetts, of primary care. The two points that I would make here is that preventive benefits first dollar are going to have an impact on premiums. We know that. In and of themselves, it might not be significant, but when you combine it with things like limiting lifetime limits, limiting some annual limits in concert, those things could have a larger impact on premiums. And then again, there's the provider capacity point that we're all very concerned about, especially in primary care. With respect to the long-term reforms, I think Gary and Chris touched on sort of the flexibility that the states have. The exchange or exchanges, regional, all these different varieties and flavors we can have. I think what is unclear is the impact on ESI or employer-sponsored insurance. As Gary indicated, we're taking the exchanges up basically to 100. Beginning in 2017, there's flexibility to go much larger. One of the very important sort of analyses of that provision in advance of states deciding it, I think, is going to be the review that's going to be done to determine the adverse selection issues and the potential for smaller and smaller firms to pull themselves out of the exchange and go into the self-funding business, which is something that could potentially be very, very bad for the structure of the exchanges and that we're very concerned about. With respect to the market reforms, I think I'd like to make a comment to sort of reinforce the dependent coverage issue, the fact that this is a teaching moment for the all-important first year. In the industry, we're very concerned about having a balanced risk pool. People talk about the size of pools. Size is much less important than the balance. That's why employer coverage works so well. People come together for something inherently unrelated to their health status. So it's completely random from that standpoint. The final point that I want to make is with respect to the delivery reforms. And frankly, we have to have the will to change. I think Chris alluded to this in the states, the role that they have to play. I want to emphasize the importance of multi-stakeholder support and collaboration. And then again, my capacity point in the agencies, whether CMS, whether others, whether at the state level, there's the capacity to effectuate many of these forms is a real challenge. And in closing, I think Chris also mentioned the lesson of Massachusetts that we've really got to do access delivery reform on parallel tracks. If we don't, we're just sort of pushing down the problem, putting it off, and that the real test of these reforms, I think we will work to make them work. We've got to. But the real test is going to be the sustainability over the long run and whether it's going to lower cost for people who have coverage now as well as those coming into the system. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. I guess this one is the one we need. How's that? Okay. That's terrific. That's a very good base on which to proceed to try to address some of the questions that are just below the the level at which the remarks that you've just heard were delivered. As I mentioned, you have a green card that you can write a question on and hold it up, and we'll have it brought forward. There are microphones that you can use to ask questions in your very own voice. If you choose to do that, I would ask you to both identify yourself and keep it as brief as you possibly can. Let me just start off with a question for Chris, if I can. You mentioned the decision that you had made in Rhode Island to participate in the new federal risk pool, temporary risk pool program. And it does appear as though there are a lot of states on either side of that decision. And I wonder if you could talk about how you made the choice that you made and the extent to which you were worried about the fiscal impact of this, of that set of requirements on the states fiscal situation.
Sure. I can speak more to the policy than the political. I'm sure it will be shocking, but I think there's a political agenda in some of the positions that the states are taking. But from a policy standpoint, our major concerns are that we do not have a high-risk pool. We don't want to have a high-risk pool. The track record on them is not all that great. We are pretty unusual in that we have a single carrier in our individual market. So we're talking about individuals who don't have access to their health insurance through their employer. So they are the most marginalized of all of them. And coming from one of the more regulated states, we have one individual insurer. They have to offer health insurance to anyone who comes in. They can't disqualify them. We do have medical underwriting because we got to balance that risk pool, as Scott was saying. And it works pretty well. And we have aggressive rate review. And it works pretty well. So if the feds come and offer us money to make it cheaper for people who've been uninsured, we're not going to say no to that, so long as we know the money is there, or that if the money dries up, the state is not on the hook to replace it, either contractually or politically, and so long as the feds are able to work with us rather than say, here's what you got to do. On the first part, I think the appropriate – I'm not familiar with the mechanisms of the appropriation process, but basically if we can – in our case, if the feds can contract directly with the insurer – then the state's off the hook. We're not liable financially. We're not liable administratively. And that meets that particular need. On the second one, if the flexibility piece, the feds have been pretty clear in their discussions that bring us your ideas and tell us how you think they comply with the statute, because we're working from the same plan that you are. And we think that our plan will. And so those are sort of the conditions that we're attaching on our letter going forward.
Good. Thank you. Yes.
Hi, Tony Hausner, formerly with CMS and now a volunteer with Organizing for America. I'm interested in the panel's thoughts. A number of states have filed suit objecting to the individual mandate, and I guess I'm interested in your opinions as to the likelihood of their being effective with those, you know, carrying the weight to your thoughts. I realize that it's a complicated issue and the courts will really have to weigh on that, but curious about your thoughts on that.
At this point, Rhode Island's not made a decision to join that lawsuit. I can't speak. I read what you folks write. I read in terms of the likelihood of the merits of something like that. I know from narrowly speaking, this is a statute that's passed. We're obligated to implement the statute, and as a regulator, that's my responsibility.
Speculation down here.
Okay.
Thanks.
Diane, you have I see a sea of green in front
of
you.
Sea of green, love it. We have several questions, Chris, about expanding on the interaction between Medicaid and commercial insurance that you see. What are some of the challenges you see regarding that interaction, and what steps do you think are needed to ensure a seamless interaction between Medicaid and private insurance?
That's a great question. So what we can learn a lot from Massachusetts, as they've been sort of the test case for implementing the exchange, and what some of the lessons are there are that you need commercial insurance. So who's the exchange for? The exchange is the place where individuals go to pick up their subsidy. Individuals who are employed go to pick up their subsidy if they can't afford their employer's health insurance. So you've already got people who are used to the commercial health insurance market who are working with people who operate under their rules, but yet they are going to this new market that is controlled by the state. The state has to, although for a state that goes into this, although the subsidy for the exchange will, I believe, be a tax credit, it's the state who's going to be doing the eligibility testing. Well, as an insurance commissioner, I don't know squat about eligibility testing. I know a lot about underwriting, or my staff does, so I can make sure that the rules are consistent inside and outside the exchange. But bringing someone in, doing an asset test, doing a means test, sending them down the right path, coordinating employer funds, individual funds, and a federal tax credit, I don't know anything about that. But guess what? Medicaid does. Medicaid does eligibility testing all the time. They do asset testing all the time. If they have a premium assistance program, they've been coordinating these different flows of money. Medicaid knows how to contract with health plans. They do it under Medicaid managed care. So the challenge is really at the, I think most of the tools have been, or the leeway has been given under the statute. The challenge is for the states to get their agencies to plan together, that this is not something that's owned by insurance commissioners, it's not something that's owned by Medicaid directors, but it's got to be done jointly. And sort of the point of emphasis ends up being a single door, that you got a single place where anyone's going, regardless of where the money eventually comes from, where we are doing eligibility testing, and we're trying to do that in a way that is as efficient and as market-oriented, I guess I would say, as possible.
Gary, a question. What's available for legal immigrants? Are they eligible for subsidies, or how are they dealt with in the pool? You want me to answer?
Yes.
So legal immigrants who are in the five-year waiting period and low-income and ineligible for Medicaid are allowed to purchase coverage and are eligible for subsidies through the exchange. And hopefully they'll also be getting coverage through their employer and in other ways. And if they're higher income, they can purchase coverage.
Chris, if I could just, you always have the ability to go back and reprise your last answer. Just on the exchanges, another reason why the Medicaid commercial piece is important is Scott and I both talked to the importance of delivery system transformation. The only way you're going to get delivery system transformation is if you pay for it. And the only way you pay for it is if you integrate your flows of funds to get the outcome that you want, whether it's payment reform or rebuilt primary care. And that requires much tighter coordination between the Medicaid and the commercial markets. And some people see the exchanges as helping do that.
Thanks, Chris. I agree. And one thing I want to reiterate is sort of the importance of on-the-ground collaboration. But also I want to suggest this is a point where the states are going to be somewhat uneven. So, for example, one thing that we know is that states that operate an integrated Medicaid CHIP program generally do a better job keeping track of those kids and keeping continuity of coverage. It's something that we're very focused on. Again, back to the dependent issue, states that operate siloed programs separate Medicaid, SCHIP, and might not have, say, for example, an Office of Health Reform are going to be much slower to get this done. So there's got to be a lot of effort and a real concerted push on the ground to try and get everyone on the same page in advance of 2014.
Yes, go ahead. Hi, I'm Elizabeth Urenka from Congresswoman Melissa Bean's office. I have one question for Scott, of course, and then a concern that anyone can really answer. I guess you were talking about transparency in premium increases, and I'm wondering if there is any movement to move that also in terms of transparency of pricing as now we see beneficiaries as consumers of healthcare. There's been a big call to actually know what the cost of healthcare is. Understanding why your insurance company negotiates different prices for different procedures, and you can go to the hospital and not know what you're really coming out with. As part of any of these pilots, is there a movement in that direction? And then my second question is on the federal fallback for those state high-risk pools. From how you see it, I understand that they're writing the regs for right now. What is the process that you anticipate for these insurance companies to come together and bid on whether or not they're going to be responsible for doing the federal fallback? I guess there's a concern with the amount of money that we're giving for the high-risk pool that some of that could be drawn away if we don't have a competitive bid process for the person who's actually going to administer the federal fallback.
Yeah, I think with respect to the transparency issue, as I said, we've been working with the NIAC. Secretary Sebelius spoke at our policy conference in March, and Karen Ignani, our president, made a commitment to her that we were going to provide a template that we see as something sort of decomposing what is a premium increase and actually what is a rate increase, because they're two very different things, and generally people don't know that. I think with respect to transparency and pricing, we've been very concerned sort of with the rising incidence in provider prices, and there's ample evidence of that that's come forward. I think one thing we have to be very careful of is that too much transparency is a price signal to the market, and I think the regulatory authorities at the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, and others have said that that could actually reduce competition. But in terms of putting price information out there, we have a number of AHIP members that have been doing that in markets now. Sometimes there's a barrier, again, at the federal level or the state level, or also there may be a barrier given the provider may actually, and some what we call must-have providers may say, you know, you guys aren't going to, you know, we're not going to participate in this transparency effort of yours, and if you want to do it, then we're just not going to contract with you. So that's a challenge. I think on the risk pool issue, a number of our carriers operate risk pools now in a number of states. I don't know what the number is. I can't imagine that the process wouldn't be competitively bid. I have no clue what the rules will be, but there could be a case of where a state decides that they're going to just sort of morph their existing pool into the new pool. But we know there have been a number of concerns about that, and anyone who wants to look at something on it, Chris's colleague, Sandy Prager, who's the commissioner in Kansas, had a really good discussion on the New York Times prescription blog, I think a week or so ago, about some of the challenges and the equity issues, because many of the existing pools are sort of less generous, just to be very general about it. But I don't have any insight to that. But certainly, I mean, we support having all of our members have an opportunity to bid on something in a local market.
Can I just ask, you said something that certainly rang true, and that is that some people don't know the difference between a premium increase and a rate increase, and I'm one of them. Could you take 30 seconds and explain, or 45 seconds and explain the difference between the two and why it's important?
Sure. I'll try to use a simple example. So think about the small group market, which, as Gary said, is currently a market that in most states is 2 to 50. Think about a firm that has 15 employees and is, say, an auto body repair shop. Conventional wisdom would suggest to people that that firm represents one pool. That's not exactly true. That firm represents one pooled group within a series of similar pools in a similar product, a policy form. So, for example, in Washington, D.C., say, there could be in carrier A's a block of that pool, there could be 200 groups that look like Ed's auto body repair that are characteristics, say, between group size 10 and maybe group size 25, and have a number of other characteristics similar occupation. That big group of, say, 200 represents one pool or one rate, right? The premium is with respect to the individual group within that broader pool, if that's helpful. Yeah. And then the premium can vary within existing rules somewhat based upon the experience of that group. And again, this is one of the reasons why, in the context of the exchanges, employers are going to do what's natural to make decisions based upon what's best for them. And that's why there's a potential for adverse selection, people either going into the exchange, staying out of the exchange. And when we get up to larger and larger group size, there's also the potential for firms to self-fund, which would pull themselves out of the broader, fully insured pool, and base essentially their premiums on only their own experience. Because when you self-fund, you don't have premiums. You only have claims, and our members generally act as administrators. So
that's very helpful. Chris, you want to add something?
Yeah. So the auto body guy's premium might go up depending on changes in census and changes in benefits, even if it's an adjusted community rate state. If it's not an adjusted community rate state, then it could go up based on medical experience. So think of rates as your underlying medical inflation. In terms of the question of transparency, I will say from our standpoint in Rhode Island, we have put less of an emphasis on medical price transparency and more on health insurer rate transparency. So what we have done in our state is actually standardize the rate factor review process. So now all health plans have to come in at the same time with all the factors that they use to calculate their rates, price and utilization over five medical service categories, plus admin costs, plus inflation. We collect it, we publish it, we lay it side by side, and then we start asking questions why you are all predicting hospital price increases at 8 to 9%. As an underlying trend, on top of which you have to put utilization. Well, that starts a pretty interesting conversation around why is it that the health insurers think that hospital costs are going up at that rate. And then the hospitals say, well, it's all cost shifting. It's Medicaid, it's Medicare, it's uncompensated care. And the health plans say, we're not paying 8 or 9% to everybody. That's 10 to some and 2 to others. And the ones we're paying 10 to are the ones who we got to have. They're the ones with market power. We are less optimistic about, but, and by the way, sometimes that rate review process ends up being a giant kick me sign for the regulator, because when you run public input processes, the only people who weigh in are the politicians who have to say, this is an outrage, and then they get to wave the letter around. But you do get, you make the case, you educate stakeholders about what is driving underlying cost increases, that more insurer competition won't necessarily do it, that we have to get at the kind of delivery system transformation underlying that. Price increases, we have not seen as much traction on from a consumer standpoint yet. Some people with high deductible health plans get it and they go ask, but their quality of information they get back is pretty bad. And if we're trying to, if we have to prioritize our activities, we're going to start with insurer price transparency and the rate piece, because we think we can get the public conversation going. On the federal high-risk pools, our impression from speaking with HHS is they have not thought through the issues of the federal fallback, that they are, first things first, they are trying to get the information out to the states, and I think it's in their interest to have as many states step forward as can who offer to comply with the statute, because it's considerably more complicated to run any kind of federal fallback program. And I think you'll see the same thing with the exchanges in 3 years, too. Running a federal exchange is going to be a mess. If you can get the states to do it that fits the local markets, I wouldn't be surprised to see that emerge as the preferred option.
We do have a question about whether states might start running the exchanges earlier than 2014. Do you think many will try?
What's the phrase, irrational exuberance? I don't know. I mean, maybe states might try, but the big thing you need to run the exchange is all that money. It's the increase in Medicaid. This is all of a piece. It's the individual. You can't do an exchange without an individual mandate. You need the individual mandate. You need the Medicaid expansion. And you need the subsidies. It's very hard to do before that on your own.
And Diane, even if you tried to do it where you didn't provide the same level of access that you were thinking about after 2014, you still need some kind of comparability to. For an exchange to make any sense, and at the moment the products are all over the place. So, you could start to see some websites maybe after the federal one that's coming out that puts things in buckets that people could start to look at in a little more systematic way. But it's still going to be really hard until you get to the standard plans, and then it's
you have to be in Massachusetts.
Right.
They already started pretty.
I think one of the 640 thou shalts that the secretary has to do in the bill is to define an essential benefit, which is critical to an exchange. And I don't know that a state is going to want to take that on before the feds do.
You know, to make one point, too, the early internet portal, and there is sort of a comparability provision that's going into effect in a year, is one thing that I think is important. And the second thing, just to follow up on Chris's point about transparency, and you alluded to Massachusetts. This is sort of what's going on there now for anyone who hasn't been watching, and it's a real, I think, instructive case, learning moment for federal reform, what we're going to confront. But I just want to say one thing about price being underlying medical trend. That's partly true, and the other part to that is that when we talk about price, there's underlying medical trend, which is medical inflation, and then there are price increases above medical inflation, which are some of the factors. And then on top of that, there's utilization. And then that's what, those are the primary movers. And then when we get into other issues, adverse selection, cost shifting, you mentioned, those are important but much smaller.
Hi, I'm Mary Agnes Carey with Kaiser Health News. I wanted to direct a couple questions to Chris, but if others want to jump in, go for it. Chris, you talked about how people are calling your office to find out, for example, how they keep their adult child under age 26 on their policy. Has HHS told you when they're going to give you the guidance for that and some of the other more immediate reforms? And the second question is, you talked about how you'll probably hear more from people whose rates will go up than those will go down. As you look at your state and look at this bill, who will pay more for their health insurance generally, and who do you think will pay less?
On the first part, I believe HHS has put out a guideline for how these, when these regs will be issued and the promulgation process. I'm not familiar with what that is, frankly, and and left unspoken or still to be worked out is what's the role of the states in communicating that versus HHS. I do think an important player in this will be the benefit advisors, the brokers, who the good brokers are sweating this very carefully for their clients, are tracking the HHS stuff out and getting the information. So in some ways, our job as the states is to pay attention to the folks who aren't covered. You know, it's typical public function. So self-insured, they'll figure it out. Brokers, large companies will figure out. It's going to be the individuals and the smaller businesses. In terms of winners and losers, typically it's going to be the winners will be groups that are predominantly older and sicker, and the losers will be groups that are predominantly younger. So, for instance, in Rhode Island, when we implemented adjusted community rating, this is kind of funny, the one group went up and got an exemption from adjusted community rating in the small group market, and it was the builders, because the builders were absolutely convinced that they were going to get nailed, that they were on the low side because they had young, healthy construction workers, and so therefore they wanted an exemption. They wanted to be rated on their own, and because they had good lobbying, they got it. But because we're regulators, we've been able to track what their rates are. And guess what? The builders have tracked, their increases have tracked exactly what the small group has. No difference at all. So a lot of it is perception. And then there is this issue, which I think states can do something with, around the notion of rate shock. That's an insider term, but it means if I'm a small group, I got 10, and I replace a 50-year-old employee with a 25-year-old employee, well, I'm going to see a much lower rate of increase, and I'm going to feel pretty good about that. But if I do the reverse and I replace a 25 with a 55, I'm going to see a big increase, and I'm going to be angry at somebody. Well, there are ways, if you're consistent, that you can clip the edges and say there will be no rate decrease below this and no rate increase above this. And we have found that that's pretty helpful to kind of reduce the up and down that happens with small groups.
And let me just encourage, if I know there were a number of folks from HHS registered for this briefing, if any of you would like to come forward and answer the question about the regulatory schedule.
Ed, I think you've just sent people crawling under the table.
Next. Hi. Excuse me. Sorry. I'm Jen Stewart. I'm sure some of you may have seen me at these events in the previous couple weeks, but I'm a med student at Georgetown, a third-year med student going into primary care, and I'm kind of working on a fun project, which is comparing our healthcare system and the way that the new bill with other countries and with single-payer kinds of national health insurance programs. So some of the things that I'm coming across are we're paying twice what other countries are paying who have national insurance in healthcare, meaning about $6,000 per capita, six to seven. We have 17% of our GDP rate, or 17% of our GDP is going towards healthcare, which is much higher than all of the other industrialized countries with the national health insurance program. And the premiums are increasing at much faster rate than inflation and then workers' wages. And then I was looking at some of the outcomes, which is really sad because we have some of the worst infant mortality, we have the worst maternal mortality, we have shortest life expectancy, less visits to doctors, and fewer nurses, and less time in the hospital. So these things are things that concern me. So I'm concerned, basically, I feel like we're kind of forcing people to buy a defective product. And, you know, it's expensive, it denies care, it's good for stakeholders and for CEOs who are making a lot of money off of it. But for the primary care providers who care about patients and not profits, what do you think are the biggest changes in the bill that will improve the product for patients and, you know, to get us to have better outcomes, more availability, decreased premiums, better coverage, more primary care and cost control? The biggest change that will help patients.
So what your comparison didn't have is the percentage of money that's spent on primary care, which in England and Spain is around 25 to 27%, and in the U.S. is about 5.5 or 6. And we are never going to get at the cost nut without copying that. And the only way we're going to get at the at that is by a conscious policy decision. And I would argue that federal health reform makes those conscious policy decisions much more likely and actually puts a thumb on the scale for primary care in a few places. Expansion of National Health Service Corps, expansion of community health centers, Medicare demos, and giving more authority to the states. So in our state, we've told the health plans as a condition of their rate factor review, they've got to increase their primary care spend. They've got to increase it from 6% in 08 to 11% in 2012. And the leading candidate for that is probably going to go into these all-payer, patient-centered, medical home, primary care collaboratives. So, no, is it a home run? No. But it gives us a lot more tools to advance towards the kind of goals that you're talking about.
Yeah, I think the thing I would add is if you haven't looked yet, Uwe Reinhardt, Jerry Anderson, and colleagues wrote, I think in 2004, Health Affairs, It's the Price is Stupid, is fantastic reading, comparing international systems. And what they tell you is that it is the price is stupid because there's such a difference in price between what's paid here and what's paid in foreign systems. When we talk about specialists, I've seen data that suggests that the difference in specialty physician compensation in the U.S. and abroad in the OECD is a factor of 6X. I don't know if that's right, but I remember seeing the data. And then the final thing that I would add is that, to Chris's point, specialty versus primary and reimbursement, the challenge from a plan standpoint, again, what we call a must-have provider, in many cases you have one anesthesiology practice. So that anesthesiology practice from a negotiating standpoint can put a plan in a really difficult position. And sometimes, for example, you know, might be getting 6X or 10X on Medicare reimbursement, which I cite Medicare because that's what's most commonly available as a comparison. So there are really competitive factors that are a challenge that feed into that as well.
Gary?
Just a couple things. One is, I mean, one thing we do have more of than most other countries is
Is your microphone working?
Is that working? One thing we do have more of than most of these countries are higher administrative costs. There's a pretty good McKinsey report looking at this. The bill does reduce administration, particularly, and then probably substantially in the individual market, some in the small group market. There's some other things that move towards more efficient administration that makes up a little bit of it, probably not a lot, but there's something moving in that direction.
So you guys are telling me there's hope.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, because I'm not feeling it from the primary care's perspective as much as maybe everybody else. But.
Come to Rhode Island.
Right.
Yeah.
We
got hope.
And I guess one other thing I should say, there's a pretty good article by, I think, Richard Frank and Joe Newhouse, looking at the difficulty that private plans have negotiating when there's monopolies on the other side. And That was done in the context of the Medicare prescription drug benefit and the drugs that are still on patent with no competitors. But that's true in some of the instances that Scott mentioned, as well as some of the hospital examples that Chris mentioned, where if you have must-have providers and you can't really have a network without them, at least Medicare does a much better job getting good prices from them than private payers have been able to.
The May issue of Health Affairs gets into this a lot. Actually, we have an article on the Rhode Island piece in there. So.
It's all about primary care.
All about what?
primary care.
We have a question about grandfathering provisions and the grandfather plans in terms of the new requirements for benefits. If a grandfather plan doesn't cover all the preventive services, will it have to add that coverage? When will it have to do that? At renewal of the plan year in 2014? When? Or ever?
For preventive services without cost sharing?
Preventive services.
Yeah. I think that's only applicable to new plans.
Actually, that was a reconciliation change,
was it?
I think, that it applies to grandfathered plans. There were three provisions that applied to grandfathered plans. I think dependent was one. Preventive first dollar, I think, was the other.
I'm not sure.
Jen,
I believe
her
so.
Head.
It doesn't apply. Yeah.
That's what I thought.
If you look at,
I think that's what the NAIC thing says.
I stand corrected.
If you look at your document in there, it lists it as an exempt, that it does not apply.
That's what I thought. But there are so many different provisions here, and there were some of them were renumbered four times during just in the same bill plus the reconciliation bill. So we're going to make mistakes on this stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could comment on the effect of comparison shopping will have on premiums in the exchange. Some people look to orbits and the fact that people can comparison shop and how that's driven down prices for airline tickets. CBO was probably not as enthusiastic that it will have as powerful a force driving down premiums. So I was wondering if you could comment.
The experience in Massachusetts has been that the price pressure in the exchange has been applied completely by the state, the connector, in terms of negotiating with the individual health plans. And you see now they're having a big tussle over what that is. I think if the exchange was the only place to buy health insurance and there were some sorts of product requirements, product structures, then you have a lot more opportunity for price pressure. But in Massachusetts, because of political pressures, you can get your, as an employer, you can get your insurance inside the exchange or outside the exchange through the existing market because they wanted to promote choice and they wanted to make it acceptable to the existing players, the plans and the brokers. And that's resulted in much less price competition. So if you make it the only game in town, it can happen in theory, but that's a tough political lift.
I think one potential difference anyway is the structure of the federal bill. The subsidies are tied to the second lowest cost plan of a certain level. I think that puts an additional amount of pressure on premiums because subsidized people are going to enroll. They're not going to want to pay. They have to pay the complete difference between what they get in subsidy and
right.
the cost of the next higher cost plan. So I think there's a lot of pressure to if you want to enroll get significant enrollment through an exchange to have as low premiums as possible.
And one of the issues that arose in an earlier program that we did on it, specifically on exchanges, spotlighted the importance of what Chris was talking about, if not an exclusive arrangement for the exchange, at least one in which the prices are the same inside and out.
Right, the underwriting.
And where are we in the federal law with that provision? Can insurance companies charge differently inside and outside for the same product?
No and yes. no, if you offer the same plan in and out, you have to charge the same price. If you offer a different plan out, then it can be different. There's risk, you know, there's requirements about this some provision that's called a single risk pool provision, and we'll see what that means. Maybe that can allow some tying together of the premiums or not. There's no requirement that an issuer only, you know, there are issuers who could only be outside exchanges, still in the market. They still have to meet the structure of the benefits in terms of the benefit levels and the essential benefits and such, but they won't be a qualified health plan in terms of the exchanges. And I don't think we quite know how that'll work. But the subsidies are what's driving a lot of new people into this market. Those are only available in the exchange. They're only available in qualified health plans. That probably is going to set the standard of what happens. But there's room around the edges for some mischief.
Okay.
Generally speaking, the rules are the same inside and outside of the exchange, which is really important to limit adverse selection, and again, is one of the lessons of Massachusetts.
Thank you. I'm Todd Leuenberg with Thompson Publishing. I was hoping you could discuss some of the future impacts on employer plans, employer-sponsored health plans, specifically of the unaffordable coverage rules, which would mean that if the cost sharing, the contribution of the premium is above 8%, and then again 9.5 or 9.8%, those members would be encouraged or leave the plan or get a subsidy and possibly leave the plan. Under one scenario, they would get free choice voucher from the employer. What would be the impacts on employer plans? And, you know, when I listen to employers, they want to keep members in plans, and they're concerned this would be a way that they would lose plan members to the exchange. And then ultimately, do you think that, and they've complained that they think they might be forced or impelled to just pull up stakes and wrap up their plan and stop offering this benefit and just allow their population to go to the exchange entirely. And that's what I've heard, and I'm wondering what do you think those impacts on employer plans would be, and how would they handle the possibility that they have unaffordable coverage or have to pay a free choice voucher?
I'll start. I think I mentioned that one of the key study provisions, I think, is going to be this annual report that I believe the Labor Department is supposed to do on the impact of the exchanges on the market dynamic and the potential for adverse selection and the potential for self-funding, which is also in part driven by some things such as the health insurance provider fee that's on health plans, because that applies to fully insured in individual plans but doesn't apply to self-funded arrangements. So that's yet another reason for people to pull themselves out of the pool, because there's a competitive advantage there in terms of the cost and pricing. I think the answer is we don't really know, and I think there's going to be a lot of different impacts by market that's driven by the exchange. And in particular, I think we're focused on the 2017 issue when there's the opportunity for the exchanges to be opened beyond group size 100, because you get into the potential for a lot of really unique situations when you get into larger and larger groups.
Yeah, I would just say it's the two-word answers, don't know. It's really speculative. There are people in this room who would say the demise of employer-based health insurance might not be a bad thing. From a rational market standpoint, if you could have individuals purchasing, you'd have people who select to go into narrow network plans. Those choices get moved to individuals. There are others who are concerned about equity and things like that. And I think that the behavior of – I think it'll hinge, as you've said, on the behavior of the individuals with the subsidy and where they go and how they act, how the exchange is set up. And I heard someone speculate around the large self-insured. At some point, it may be economically rational for some, particularly not national, but regional or local self-insured companies to say, you know what, here's a big fat voucher, and I'm going to control the trend going forward, so I'm going to give you an increase. But you that exchange looks pretty good. Go shop and look at it. Now, that depends on how strong the labor market is. So it's all pretty speculative at this point.
Gary
Scott.
Gary. I mean, I guess I would just say employers offer health benefits in order to attract workers, because that's a compensation package they want to put together and that their workers want to see. You've changed the economics when you have alternatives to that, clearly, but those alternatives are primarily beneficial to lower-income people who have a hard time in the employer-sponsored market now. There's going to be some changes, particularly for employers who have a lot of low-wage employees. Those employees weren't necessarily well served in the employer sponsor market, and those will be the ones that might move, and those employers might actually think that's better. Right. We'll just see how it plays out.
Go ahead.
Hi, this is a question for Chris and probably Scott. I'm Drew Armstrong with Bloomberg News. A question on medical loss ratio, specifically to the individual market where the requirement's at 80%, but there's in the law some secretarial authority to go lower than that if necessary. I'm wondering, Chris, if you could talk a little bit about balancing the concerns about solvency given current MLRs in some cases in the individual market and whether or not you all think that it might be necessary to dip below 80, how far, and whether broadly or just in some specific cases in terms of setting those rates as NAIC goes about that process. And Scott, I'm sure, might have some thoughts on this as well.
Well, first, I'll just speak from a state regulatory standpoint. The individual market is so small that the effect of pricing the individual market medical loss ratio is immaterial to the overall solvency of the plans that I regulate. It's just it's tiny. So if you're concerned about the solvency of plans, or when you are concerned, you have to look at bigger chunks of business. And generally, that's not going to be driven by whether an MLR is 75 or 85 in the individual market. There just aren't that many, aren't enough folks there to drive it one way or another. I think that the setting of the medical loss ratio measures and that process sort of embodies a lot of how this federal health reform will roll out, because the HHS is relying heavily on NAIC to do that. In turn, within NAIC, it's a technical conversation. How do we measure these things? What are the categories? And then you got to, and how do we measure the judgment calls, like quality and disease management and things like that? And then we got to decide, are they administrative, or HHS has to decide, are those really administrative or medical? I am, there remain, regardless of how that target is set, there remain ample tools within insurance commissioners to go after, to take action on a plan when they're concerned about solvency. So I'd say the issues around medical loss ratio are around affordability and accuracy and transparency, less around solvency. If we're concerned about the solvency of a plan, it will have less to do with the MLR measurement, and there are plenty of tools that are in our toolkit to conduct examinations and things like that.
Yeah, I mostly agree with what Chris said, and I think I would just add, you know, as I emphasized, the provision is a real challenge for the existing individual market because, again, as Gary pointed out, we know the exchanges are going to lower administrative costs, but that's in 2014, and this provision is going into effect much sooner. And one of the areas that we're really concerned about is competition. And I know from the standpoint of especially the smaller local plans, the regional plans, and new plans, solvency is inextricably linked. So I think there is the issue of solvency in a bigger plan. The individual market is a small, finite market now. But with respect to a plan that may be interested in trying to be a participant in the new market and maybe a small plan now in particular, it's a real challenge given those rules. So there's a delicate balance to strike.
Separate from solvency, but another part of the MLR provision that is going to give us all gray hairs is the rebate. I mean, thanks a lot, guys. This is implementing the rebate provision, how you do that, who gets the rebate, what happens if they've left, what's the plan year, what happens if they've left, how is it allocated among products, among businesses. That's going to be pretty difficult.
And the rebate occurs if you don't meet the MLR target? Is that the idea?
If the health plan's performance for a given year, given time period, falls below the MLR target established by HHS.
Bob Rohr with BMJ. In terms of trying to contain costs in healthcare delivery to so-called bend the curve, there really hasn't been all that much in terms of price competition and things. On the private side, for individuals who are sort of self-insured, we're starting to see development of sort of a medical tourism business where, especially for expensive procedures and things like cosmetics that are paid out of pocket, people are going overseas because for some of the bigger ticket items, the cost can be half or less. So do you see this as a potential for helping to contain costs, for increasing competition on the provider side of healthcare? Do you see it as a potential aspect of competition to help keep prices contained? And on the other side, do you see state insurance commissioners potentially prohibiting such activity and trying to keep those dollars within the local market.
I guess that's for me. I don't have any data to base it on, but I've not seen the although it's increased, I don't see medical tourism as a significant force driving pricing behavior. As I said before, we've been more focused on insurance premium pricing and the ability of people to be informed shoppers there. And I was at a business session earlier this week where an elderly gentleman stood up and said, well, how is an exchange any different from what I get as Medicare, where I can choose a bunch of fee-for-service plans, Medigap plans, Medicare Advantage? And I said, that's it exactly. It's an individual purchasing. I think within that, if someone with a higher deductible chooses to spend that deductible more efficiently, you may see that, the kind of behavior that you're talking about, a little more provider price sensitivity. I never heard of an insurance commissioner interpreting their authority such that they could regulate provider activity, provider contracting activity, and things like that. So that's there may be local providers who agitate for that, but I haven't heard it yet.
Question here, are there health insurers or types of health insurance plans who are relatively better positioned to benefit from these changes to the insurance market? And who would they be?
I think the ones who already have higher loss ratios, in the short run, the ones who are larger and have better provider contracts will start out with a price advantage, and the ones who can manage as opposed to the ones who rely on risk selection.
I would, those who know how to deal with the government, Medicaid and Medicare, because there's going to be a lot more business coming in through the government just with the Medicaid expansion, the Medicaid managed care organizations.
Yeah, Carl Polzer, American Healthcare. In the statute, you know, to meet the individual mandate in the insured markets, it looks like you've got to buy something with essential benefits, and that's defined. There are components of that that are laid out, and then the Secretary's got to go over to the Department of Labor and get a study that, you know, guides that decision based on what's in the typical employer plan, which most of which are self-insured. So I'm wondering, for the self-insured plans, do we have any clue? There doesn't seem to be a similar track of, it's clear of an essential benefits standard. Do we know if the Department of Labor in some fashion is going to have to set some kind of minimum? And if not, if that can be lower than in the insured markets, which is going to have probably a fairly robust benefit package mandated, how does that contribute to the adverse selection problem that you talked about earlier?
I think we don't know yet how the Department of Labor is going to interpret some of those provisions. And I should have said that generally. There's a whole lot of stuff here where regulations are going to tell us a lot that we don't know now.
Before you ask that last question, we are getting right near the end of our time, and I want to make sure that I pitch one more time that you take a few moments and fill out the evaluation so that we can improve these programs as we go along. Diane?
Somebody who hasn't asked a question yet.
Yes.
Hi, Jessica from DC Medicaid. I was just curious to your thoughts about maybe a multi-state or a regional exchange for, you know, I've read that it might be an option for some small states such as Rhode Island and, dare I say it, DC, considered DC a state. So I just wanted to know your thoughts on that and if it's kind of the challenges that states face within itself versus would it just be a higher level because it's interstate then?
I think that's a good question, and it's a nut that we haven't cracked yet. I think the easiest thing to do collaboratively is the exchange operations. It would be, given all the money for us, for instance, given all the money that Massachusetts has invested with that spiffy-looking website, it would be silly for us to try to set up our own. You know, they could just put up our products on a separate page or something like that. The last thing we want to give away is the governance, to the extent that we want to decide how the rules work, because that's kind of that local control piece. The middle part, and the one that in a small state you get a lot of pressure on, is products and insurers and things like that. And, yeah, it's in some ways it doesn't make any sense. Our economy moves back and forth, but the products and the insurers in Rhode Island are very different from Massachusetts. I don't know how we do that
in an exchange, and it seems like if we do that in an exchange so that people in Rhode Island have access to Massachusetts products, we've got to do it for the whole market. So the economists and some politicians are always pressing for that, and I frankly don't have a really good answer for them, except to say we can regionalize the operations pretty easily.
Although I think once 2014 runs around and you have the essential benefits, and states that require additional benefits would have to pay the subsidy costs associated with them, you're going to move to very much more similar products, potentially state to state. There might be more opportunity for collaboration, although giving up the sort of political oversight and delegating the right to protect your consumers, depending on how you do that, I think are tough issues for states.
Ask that overarching question.
We're out of time, so we would only have 1 second for everyone to answer. Is what's your greatest fear about an unintended consequence or a big problem in implementing these provisions? Your one biggest fear.
I don't have any.
He's known as fearless.
Scott.
I think, for me, it's adverse selection. And again, I go back to, you know, what I call the all-important first year and having balance in that pool.
My biggest fear as a regulator is a drastic change in course. We can do stuff. We can handle mid-course corrections and tweaks and things like that, but a right-angle turn is just going to wreak havoc.
Well, those are words to live by or avoid dying by. I apologize to those of you who didn't get your questions asked or answered, but maybe you can figure out a way to relate them to Medicare and ask them next week, because we're going to be talking about Medicare and reform in the same slot next Friday. Where are we next week? I think we're in Russell. We'll be in the Russell building. Please fill out your evaluations. Thanks to the Kaiser Family Foundation for its active participation in the program. Thank you for asking good questions, and help me to thank our panelists for a great discussion. That's right. We have only silhouettes.
I was waving it around.
How are you?
Oh, we could. That's the.